am required to tell you this is KCSN and KCSN HD1 Northridge KSBR and KSBR HD1 Mission Viejo.
That's our legal name.
But this is the SoCal Sound, member-supported public radio for music lovers. Join us on the SoCal Sound app and the SoCalSound.org.
A very happy Wednesday evening to you all, and welcome back to The Soundtrack, a show where we listen to and talk about all things musical pertaining to film and television. I am your host, TV and film director Lev L. Spiro, and tonight we have a wildly overachieving guest, a returning guest, actually. This gentleman is a highly sought-after composer, producer, songwriter, and guitarist. If I read you his whole list of credits, it would take most of the hour. But a few of the films he scored include Get Carter, Dawn of the Dead, Miss Congeniality 2, Zack Snyder 300, Watchmen, Sucker Punch, Guardians of the Galaxy, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, Atomic Blonde, Deadpool 2, John Wick, John Wick Chapter 2, John Wick Chapter 3, Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw, and John Wick Chapter 4. And another couple dozen I'm leaving out. I'm kind of tired just reading that list, my God. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back Mr. Tyler Bates.
Woo! Audience.
Tyler, welcome back, and thanks for taking time out of your schedule to come in tonight. I know people loved hearing about your work last year, and unfortunately some gremlins snuck into the master computer here at the SoCal Sound, and that show didn't get recorded, so a lot of folks didn't get to hear your music, and we're going to remedy that tonight. I have many questions for you, my friend, but before we dive in, I wanted to put a track in the ears of our listeners. That's what we just heard. A lot of folks would have recognized that cue from the opening sequence of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, composed by Mr. Tyler Bates. That was called Showtime, A-Holes, and I meant to play it right here, but we had a little miscommunication. That's such a great theme, Tyler. When you're composing orchestral pieces like that, do you write on guitar or keyboards?
I almost always write on my mind, and I will then transcribe it on a piano, but in that particular case, I do recall the Guardians of the Galaxy theme. I thought I had it prior to production of the film. I was writing different themes to pre-viz sequences.
Okay.
And, you know, those are animated renderings of action sequences and other scenes in the movie. It's kind of an elevated storyboard for the director and all of the technical artists who are going to be working on it. And so I wrote a lot of the thematic material for both of those movies before they were shot. And I thought I had it, but actually the main theme that I had written ended up being, what was it called? I'll remember the name. You know, the soundtracks all have their own names.
Yeah.
But so James Gunn and I were talking on the phone about a month into my scoring process for that one. And he's like, dude, he said, you know, I love all of our music, but I think the Guardians theme needs to just be a little bit more triumphant.
Okay.
I said, okay, let me work something up for you. And then
that was pretty darn triumphant. Good job.
Yeah, so that one I actually did on the guitar.
Ah, okay.
And I just literally did them as like audio notes on my phone and just sent it to him. So neither of these wet your whistle, and he said, absolutely, the first one is it. So
were you just using your phone to record your guitar through an amp or something?
Yeah, but I put the bass notes in with the melody on top, so okay. He was able to hear the bass movement. And
it's funny how low-tech it can get sometimes.
Well, sometimes the starkness of something like that enables someone to really see or hear what it is you're trying to communicate, instead of me producing out something. It might actually even be misleading, because in a way I might consume some kind of space or suggest that it needs to be one thing as opposed to another thing. And by doing this in such a minimalist fashion, I knew James well enough after working with him for all those years, that he would understand what I was intimating musically.
We like to say less is more. You know, if you offer people the basics of something, they can read into it what they want to as well.
Yeah, well, that's like the, you know, I'm sure that's been performed by many marching bands. So it's a very big, big theme.
Has it? I'd like to hear that.
Oh, totally.
All right, well, here's another piece that to me is every bit as atmospheric as a full orchestra, but seems much more guitar and synth driven. This is the opening title music for John Wick 3 Parabellum. Again, that really sets the tone for the film, dark, brooding, driven, suspenseful. Well, let me back up for a second. For people who don't really understand the role of a composer in film and television production, how would you describe what a composer does? What is your primary goal when you're composing?
Well, there are a couple aspects about a movie that I need to understand in order to even begin getting to work on the musical.
Okay.
Assignment. One, obviously, I need to understand the material. So I do read it, watch the film, read it again. And then through discussions with the director and perhaps, you know, if it's a producer or a studio executive that's going to have creative involvement in our process, you know, I want to understand their sensibilities the best I can through conversation so that I can create music that I feel is appropriate for the film and hopefully take some risks.
So you're trying to make sure you're on the same page creatively as far as the tone of the film.
Yeah, the thing I don't want to do is create music, even if I think it's cool, that renders like the director as someone who's a stranger in their own film.
Yeah.
So
that'd be bad.
So the key is to really understand their sensibilities the best I can without them saying, well, I like this, this, and this. I mean, it's good for me to know what they like to do in life that is not filmmaking or, you know, just anything that they find to be good quality or interesting to them or what they like to do in the time off or restaurants they like to eat at. It all is informative.
You like to find out what restaurants your directors like to eat at before you work with them. That's I've never heard that before. So
well,
it could be like a Kentucky Fried Chicken kind of movie, or it could be a Lutece.
Yeah, but yeah. I have no bias. You know, you like the KFRC? Bring it. So, no, it's really just, I mean, that was just for instance.
Yeah.
Just through conversation, it's really great to understand, like I said, the sensibilities of a person and not judge them, but understand them. And it's actually been it's paid a tremendous dividend in my work as a songwriter, album record producer, working with different artists. Because, again, I'm trying to help them tell their story. It's not just about a song that we're writing. It's what really do they need to say as an artist
it's
at that point
so
in time.
It's so interesting that you talk about it on a social level, that it's about your relationships with the people that you're working with. It's a really interesting that you describe it that way. So, you know, music in film can achieve so many things. It can establish mood. It can create atmosphere. It can suggest time and location. It can reinforce or foreshadow narrative developments, all these things. But its most important function for me, one of the things I love about your composing so much, is one of the most important functions is to evoke emotion. So I want to play another one of your cues. This one is called The Expansion. This is from, again, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Check this out. This is The Expansion.
Thank you.
You know, what makes your scores really special to me is they manage to be their own character or narrative element without distracting from the human characters, and that's such a fine line to walk with music and film. Can you talk about how you approach score as a composer? What do you talk about when you first sit down with the director, other than where they like to eat? Have you already read the script so you come in with ideas?
Yes. Yeah, for sure. And I'm not going to propose any ideas until I listen to what the director is after. Obviously, they want me to be familiar with the material before we have an in-depth discussion about the musical objective. But I always have ideas. Mm-hmm. But what I'm trying to give the movie as much as it needs, but not more than it needs. However, there are some movies I've done, like, say, The Devil's Rejects, which is a very depraved score, as Rob Zombie wrote and directed that film. It's one of my favorite scores, but it's filthy. It's like you're...
It's filthy musically?
Filthy. Okay. Yes. It's almost like the musical equivalent of being trapped under an idling diesel engine or something.
Oh,
it's
my. Okay.
Really, that really does gnarly. Sound but that was the objective, really. Uh-huh. It was about being very uncomfortable, but not so much as a visual. It's not like I was trying to do it more from an internal psychological state. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't just a reaction to what we were seeing. Unless I do remember in that movie, there was a guy who did become very demonstrative with a stapler on someone else. And the music was pretty much
demonstrative.
Yeah, okay. The music was echoing his deft movement with the stapler.
But generally, you're talking about setting an atmosphere and setting the tone of the film that way, as opposed to trying to describe narrative events.
And as far as emotion is concerned, I've certainly had a tremendous amount of experience in my life that has made me fairly well-versed in all emotion.
I'm sorry to hear that. It's called being human, but yeah.
Yes, you live long enough, you get them all. But, you know, the first scene in the first Guardians really, I think, is Peter Quill is at his mother's bedside, and she's about to die.
Yeah.
And there's obviously a very strong connection between them. And she is very, very much into music. Hmm. That was it with my mom and I. We used, back in the day before the streaming and all, you know, you had to go to the record store to buy music.
So you felt a very personal connection with that.
Hell yeah. My mother and I used to go to the record store every Tuesday, and we would buy new records, or we would ask the clerks what came in, because there weren't that many outlets to learn what was new each Tuesday.
Yeah.
But we really shared a tremendous bond, turning each other on to music, mostly she showing me better music than I was listening to.
Thanks, Mom. Where was this, by the way? What city were you in?
At that point, we were living outside of Chicago on a horse ranch, but I'm from L.A.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, Chicago is such a great music city, too, if you like blues, especially.
Yeah.
But maybe not the horse ranches as much.
No, that was a different thing.
Well, I want to play another one of my favorite tracks from John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum. And this one goes along with a great fight sequence with Keanu Reeves, Halle Berry, and her two trained attack dogs. I didn't realize that when I was listening to it, and I went back and said, wait, where was this from? And I was like, oh, my God, this not only my favorite scene from the film, but my dog's favorite scene. Yeah, this is my dog's favorite part of the film. This is called Dance of the Two Wolves.
We'll be right back.
Tyler, in addition to all this amazing composing, you've also produced three albums for Marilyn Manson, and you go out on tour with him as his music director and his lead guitarist. And you're in the middle of a tour now, right? How's it going?
It's great. It's actually been an incredible experience on a number of levels. Obviously, you know, people who have followed Manson's career have known that he's declined over time and had some issues over the past few years, but he has really dedicated himself to being the best person he can be, the best artist he can be, physically great shape, looks amazing, awesome to work with, and every performance he is phenomenal.
You were just telling me that this band that you're touring with now is the best you've ever played with this band. I mean, incredibly tight and connected.
Mm-hmm.
And you said something very interesting to me before we started the show, which was just that this was the first time you'd gone out touring where, you know, you're not sober in the sense of you never have alcohol, but you used to have, a couple sips of tequila before you'd go on stage, and now you're doing it just straight with no numbing or loosening agents, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. Like when I was in my early 20s back in the last century.
It was, yeah.
I mean, sometimes I would get hammered, you know, because especially playing at clubs, people bring up trays of Jack Daniels or whatever garbage, and we would just, they kind of force you to drink it in front of the whole audience. So that had its charms, and it was fun, but my liver was spry back then.
Spryer.
And I actually didn't have, a whole lot that I needed to do the next day. I'm booked, on the quarter hour these days, which is insane. But so anyway, what happened was, Manson and I have had a very interesting on again, off again relationship over the last 12, 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when he approached me about working together again and showed me the work that he's done in his life, and once I understood completely the lay of the land of all things happening in his life,
mm-hmm.
once I was confident that it was okay to get back into the mix,
mm-hmm.
even if I got side eyes for working with him, I don't really care. I'm not the kind of person who's going to hide behind a tree because there's trouble upon my friend next to me.
I've never seen you hide behind a tree. It's
no,
true.
I do not do that. But so anyway, it's almost like, I don't know, it's a weird, almost like therapy kind of
playing live in front of crowds.
Thing that happens, the whole thing. First off, the making of the music that we did for One Assassination Under God, Chapter 1.
The new album.
Uh-huh. That came out in November. And that's done incredibly well. And we're playing a lot of that music live. And the audience is emphatic about it. Sometimes,
awesome.
Sometimes they're singing those songs louder than we are. And we're
effing
loud, okay? and we already have completed Chapter 2.
Great.
And we love that record equally.
And did you also produce this?
Yeah. So on these records, besides the drums, I play everything.
Wow.
All the instruments. And we write it simultaneously in the room. So I don't compile riffs or anything like that because the riffs are always, they're easy for me.
Well, going back to the live thing for one second, you said mm-hmm. something really interesting to me. Which was you said that
I'm being tangential.
Everybody, yes, slightly, but that wasn't the point. No, Tyler, you were saying that when everybody was not under the influence of any other substances,
mm-hmm.
that the communication on stage was really good, like the strongest it had ever been. That was interesting.
Right. So it's pretty customary for many musicians to have a sip of booze or a beer, a glass of wine or something before they go on stage, right?
A little because disinhibition. I mean, you're going up in front of 20,000 people. You got nerves.
So it takes the edge off, right?
Yeah.
Well, Manson has been extremely cool and comfortable in his sobriety. He's owned it. And
uh-huh.
I have 1,000% confidence that he's going to stay with it. But he said to me on numerous occasions, Tyler, you don't need to be sober, so don't worry about it. You can do whatever you want around me. It's up to me to maintain my own stasis, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when it came time to tour, and there were a lot of things that happened that we did to get to the point of having a record deal and a tour and all this stuff, because, there those opportunities were not available when we started writing chapter one. But once the first tour was booked last summer, I just said, look, man, I think I'm not gonna have any drinks or anything during the whole tour, because I want all of us in the band to be of the same mindset.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be...
Same wavelength, same
yes,
energy.
I want to be with him. I want to be with Reba, Matt, Gil. We're all together.
Mm-hmm.
And so nobody's a little loose because they're, you know, having a you know, some intake during the show or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's been so amazing, because at first it's striking. Okay, you come out on stage, opening, you know, our intro music plays, kabuki drops, because we usually have a kabuki that drops, a little drama. And we're there, and all those people are there. And it's like when you've got, you know, a couple of shots of tequila in you, it's a different vibe. But when you're stone sober, it's daunting. And then you just, I mean, I've kind of grown hooked on that.
Like, on sobriety. You're addicted to sobriety.
Totally
now.
On stage. Not off stage, but
okay.
On stage. But I think it's a great thing, because I want to share equally and fairly with everybody in the band the experience.
That is so cool, man. It's fascinating to hear about. Well, I want to play the first cut off of one of your early collaborations with Marilyn. This is off of the album Pale Stranger, which was the first one you produced.
Pale Emperor.
I'm sorry. Who wrote this?
You're thinking Killing Strangers.
You're right.
Right?
I'm going to talk to my stenographer. I don't actually know what a stenographer is, but I'm going to talk to them.
There'd be plenty of mistakes on there.
This was one of the key songs. Sorry, from the album Pale Emperor, this is one of the key songs in the John Wick films, co-written and produced by Tyler Bates. This is Killing Strangers.
We don't kill the ones who we love.
Killing Strangers is what we're listening to from the Marilyn Manson album, The Pale Emperor. You're listening to The Soundtrack. We're here talking to film and TV composer Tyler Bates. Tyler, Manson took some heat for that song because people kind of badly misinterpreted the lyrics. Can you tell us what the song's really about?
Well, it's kind of a funny story, but actually, when John Wick, when the directors were early on in post-production on that movie, they asked John Houlihan, the music supervisor, to get an original Marilyn Manson song that hadn't been released for the movie.
Uh-huh.
Well, it was an indie film. Like, they didn't have any money. So Houlihan, coincidentally, when he inquired, was directed to me, and he lives in my neighborhood. So he came over, and I've only known him through the film world at this point, you know. And I played him a few songs that we were working on. It wasn't even mixed. Matter of fact, the version in the film's not even a mix.
Really?
It's a demo. But so what happened is he heard that. He's like, oh, my God, when did you start doing this? And I'm like, I've been writing and producing songs my whole life, man. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, my God, this song is the perfect song for John Wick. Would you be down to have a meeting with the directors and Keanu, like, in a couple of days? I'm like, yeah, sure. And I was super busy. I was working on Guardians of the Galaxy.
You're always super busy, but okay, yeah.
The first Guardians movie, and I think we're still finishing up Californication and a few other things. So anyway, a couple of days later, they come over, and Manson's there, and it's the middle of the afternoon on a Tuesday, and, you know, they didn't have as much to do with the day as I did. But so I kind of wanted to have the meeting, and you guys, you can go now. But we played the full album that we, you know, at that point. It must have been at least 105 decibels. It was cranking in there.
Up to 11.
I have massive monitors in my studio for just this purpose. And so Killing Strangers comes on, and Keanu's just like, Manson, you're going to hear about it for the lyrics in this one. And we just started laughing because we just saw their sizzle reel for John Wick.
Right.
And it's basically a guy shooting someone in the face the whole time. And
shooting about 80 people in the face. Yeah.
So it turns out, you know, Killing Strangers is really a song that Manson wrote about his father and his experience in Vietnam.
Hmm.
And it had nothing to do with, you know, just being violent or inertly violent. So it had a deep meaning to him.
Ironic.
It is.
But yeah, I wanted people to hear that. That's what the song was actually about, his dad's experiences in Vietnam, not just going around killing strangers. Going back to composing, I want to play a short piece. This is a TV series that you did called The Punisher. It's this really cool hard blues piece with this searing guitar sound. I love the production and performance on this. Check this out. This is called The Punisher's Job. Were you using a talk box on that?
Oh, yes. I love the talk box. And we did hear it in that John Wick piece as well.
Okay.
I find it to be a really expressive, I call it an instrument, sure.
Yeah.
It's fun. And that piece, you know, it's just a 12-bar blues. Steve Lightfoot, the showrunner, when he came over to my studio to meet me, I wasn't hired officially yet. But he came over and we were talking, and I just started making that piece of music.
And that adds so much depth and flavor to the guitar sound.
Yeah, I was just showing them. And, you know, I have no qualms about using gnarly, nasty sounds. I you know, if it suits the vibe and the fabric of the film, film stock, you know, that's a lot of what I'm thinking of as far as the quality of the sound.
What kind of stock you're shooting on?
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
And how scenes are blocked, just the lighting, all of it. The actual actors and the character roles, they all impact the choices I'll make. But, you know, John Bernthal, you know, I mean, you can throw some dirt in the mix for that one. So that was really just me showing Steve an idea of what we could do with kind of like a dark, bluesy expression for
Amazing.
The Punisher.
Oh, that worked so well. Folks, you've been listening to the voice and work of Mr. Tyler Bates. We're going to take a very quick break and be right back with more peeking behind the curtains of musical wizardry and much more music right after this.
Hello, passengers. This is your captain speaking. Jet Into Work is a brand new radio show hosted by Jet for More Music in the Morning with Nick Harcourt and Jet. Our early morning flight departs at 6 a.m. Monday through Friday, so be sure to wake up with Jet Into Work on Flight 885. And on behalf of the entire flight crew, thank you for flying SoCal Sound Airwaves.
Thanks to our friends at Live Nation, the SoCal Sound has tickets for Minus the Bear's 20th anniversary tour at the Belasco. Two nights, October 11th and 12th. Current members can find contest rules and enter to be eligible for a pair of tickets at thesocalsound.org. No purchase is necessary. Tickets are on sale now at livenation.com. Minus the Bear, the Belasco, October 11th and 12th.
The SoCal Sound greatly appreciates your vehicle donations. We make it super easy, the pickup is free, and proceeds from the sale go directly to keeping your favorite programs on the air. Plus, you'll automatically be a new member or restart an existing membership. To get started with your donation, please visit thesocalsound.org and click support on the homepage. Special thanks to past car donors Rigdon Dallas, Jacob Bell, and Anne-Marie Jones.
The Gloria Barron Prize for Young Heroes recognizes young people who are making a difference in their communities and the world. Some of last year's winners have helped eradicate preventable diseases, provide free service dogs to people with disabilities. We need to celebrate heroes today more than ever. If you know a young person who is making a difference in their community, encourage them to apply now by going to barronprize.org. That's barronprize.org.
Hi there, my name's Mark, or Mookie, either one will do, and no, I don't have a $300 million contract like that other Mookie in town, nor could I hit a 90-mile-an-hour heater, but can that other Mookie guide you through classic alternative hits and feature a bunch of great new music on public radio? I'm not sure. Join me every weekday, 2 to 6 p.m. on the SoCal Sound and the SoCal Sound app.
Welcome back to The Soundtrack. I'm your host, Lev L. Spiro, and we're talking to composer, producer, songwriter, guitarist, Tyler Bates. Tyler, are you having fun yet?
I'm always having fun, Lev.
Good. Yes. I'm glad to hear it. I don't believe you, but I'm still glad to hear it. You've been asked to score a lot of kind of gritty, dark action films, maybe even pigeonholed a little bit, as we all get pigeonholed in our respective genres. But I've also heard you do all kinds of musical genres, including comedy, which is what we worked on many, many moons ago. But I was really taken with your work on a Netflix series called Agent Elvis. And I want to play for the listeners the Agent Elvis theme. Check this out. I have long been fascinated by the difficulties of scoring comedy well. As a TV director, often I've had comedy scenes destroyed by people putting very heavy-handed pizzicato cutesy scores that just scream at the audience, hey, this is supposed to be funny. You should be laughing at this. How is your approach to comedy different than for action or drama?
Well, I think, you know, I think if we set a great tone that definitely, you know, underscores the levity of a moment but doesn't necessarily punctuate the joke,
right.
I'd like to get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if the dialogue is good and the acting is good, we don't need music to do the job of making the audience
being a laugh track. Yeah.
It's actually just, you know, the absence of music, I think, is more effective most of the time. However, I was doing an action comedy film a few years ago, and a music editor literally emailed me a seventh chord and said, well, this tested funny, so you need to put it in your composition. I'm like, jeez.
That's the worst thing I've ever heard.
F off. My goodness. But, you know, I mean, whatever. There's so many people who still own instruments
right.
that like to communicate these very specific...
Here's my saxophone addition
yes.
to your score. Well, I remember how much I love the score that you created for the one film that we did together, I believe in 1997, maybe I shouldn't say that, which was my first Corman film. It was called Welcome to Planet Earth. It was a comedy starring George Wendt and Shanna Reed, and you gave me this really fun score that was very heavy on Latin rhythms and horn sections, which worked just so well for the comedy.
I love music, okay? So, you know, perhaps I'm pigeonholed, but I've been pigeonholed about 5-6 times in my career.
You've had multiple pigeonholes. That's
I was
good.
Jazz guy in the mid-90s, you know, because Blue Note put out a bebop score that I did. And then after that, I was like action comedy, urban music. I did a lot of gritty urban movies for a moment. And, you know, I grew up on so much music that inspired all that music.
Okay.
And then, fortunately, somehow with the help of music supervisor G. Mark Roswell, I got in the room with Zack Snyder to meet on Dawn of the Dead. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I was going to get hired. I'm pretty sure I wasn't going to get hired, but a few weeks after that meeting, he came back around to me, and that was one of the most fun jobs I've ever done in my life.
Is that the one that took place in the shopping mall?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I like that movie. That's a great zombie movie.
Well, it was interesting because, you know, James Gunn wrote the dialogue. He wrote the script for it.
Oh, small world.
Zack Snyder was the first film he directed.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, while I had met Rob Zombie a number of times, he was at the premiere. So soon after that, I did The Devil's Rejects. And then James and I started on Slither, and then, you know, 300, Watchmen, and a few of
that. What was the score for the Snyder film, the Dawn of the Dead? What kind of music was it?
It was probably dystopian orchestral mass with electronic music inside it.
Dystopian orchestral mass.
Yeah.
I like that.
I mean, you know, what's kind of interesting about that, you know, I'm not like a lot of most of the composers who went to school for it and studied Shostakovich and all these other Mahler and all these other composers. I'm familiar with the music, but, you know, I also love Black Sabbath and I love John Coltrane. And, you know, I mean, I love all styles of music. So
to be fair, I think Black Sabbath did borrow liberally from Mahler.
Hell yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course.
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, at that time, before Penderecki had been completely worn out by Hollywood music, I had, because I didn't have a whole great deal of sort of horror, creepy music in my repertoire.
Yeah.
And I was going up against like 12 different composers who were meeting on that movie, and they all had way more music in the genre than I did. Mr. Roswell slipped me the script early enough so I could write a couple pieces of music. And so I made it like this avant-garde CD for Zack Snyder to check out. And I'm like, if you hire me, just imagine all of these ideas are on the table. And so what happened was I said, you know, if I were to do this movie, I would use perhaps some of the orchestral mass that Penderecki creates. So this discordant orchestral sounding, and he says, well, what's a Penderecki? And just then Eric Newman, the producer, walked in with a CD in his hand, and his father is Randy Newman.
Uh-huh.
And he said, "Penderecki, that's what I have right here in my hand. My dad said if he was directing this movie, he would use Penderecki's music."
Wow.
It is the most bizarre timing.
Amazing.
So anyway, we listened to, you know, probably 90 seconds of Penderecki, and Zach was like, "That is so creepy." So, and then he hired me. And I'm like, okay, well, thank you, Christoph Penderecki.
And thank you for introducing me to Christoph Penderecki. I'm not familiar with the gentleman's music, but now I'm going to go out and seek it out. But let me share another piece from the same series that we just heard from the Agent Elvis soundtrack. This one is called TCB. I mean, you get a total sense of fun and adventure from that, but there's something very playful in it. You wouldn't hear that under a James Bond sequence. How did you do that?
Well, actually, for one, I scored that show with my friend Tim Williams, who's worked with me in various capacities over the past couple of decades. Wonderful guy, great composer, and a very good friend. So we decided to just really have fun with this. We didn't make any money doing it. We just spent it all on live horns and strings and then, you know, Gil Sharon playing drums. And
so you were actually having fun. That's why it sounds
absolutely
fun.
Absolutely. We're just having fun. So the show is a mashup between James Bond and Vegas era Elvis.
Okay.
So that's kind of where we were coming from.
And then totally get that just from the music.
And then there's, of course, Elvis's spite for different artists of the day, like the Beatles or whatever. So we would have some fun with an homage to their music or whoever else was referenced in the show. But to me, I don't have a golf game waiting for me. So when I can get into something like this with a friend, this is our Dungeons and Dragons or whatever.
That's
the heck
your
else
relaxation.
People do. You know, we have fun and we laugh and we also learn from each other. And it's just great to connect to another human being. I've been in the studio by myself so long in my life, for so many years, that I like to engage in collaborations quite frequently now. And also the people who work with me, I like to elevate their profile as well. So for, you know, Joanne Higginbottom, who's worked with me 15 years nearly now, you'll see her name as a co-composer with me on a number of projects. And I just want to make sure that, you know, people, you know, there's a light shine upon everybody who's contributed to my work, my success.
Nicely done, sir. You know, you keep talking about human connections and connecting with other people. I'm thinking, this sounds interesting. I should maybe try this someday. It's like, yeah, you never know. It could work.
You know, it feels good. And people have given me their soul. You know, when you hire people to work with you in any capacity, they can do the job. But what we're looking for is their heart and soul, and that's what I give. And you can't pay for that.
This is a great lead-in to the next track that I want to play, which is called "Plastic Heart" from the John Wick Chapter 2. Your score is such an important character in these movies. It sets the mood, it sets the tone, it maintains a constant tension and grittiness throughout. Can you talk about your initial approach or first conversations with Chad Stahelski and David Leitch?
Yeah, and just want to make sure that anyone listening who's interested, my dear friend Joel Richard is my composing partner on this, the whole John Wick series.
And here you go, and giving credit away. Yeah, well done.
He's like my younger brother, and I think he's a brilliant artistic human being.
Well, then how did the two of you come up with this?
Well, honestly, our sensibilities are so aligned that we had a a quick conversation. I was still finishing up Guardians of the Galaxy 1 when they asked me to do to John Wick, and I'm like, I can't start for another few weeks. And then they kept pushing, and I'm like, how about if I do it with a friend of mine? So Joel and I had some creative discussions, and he started laying the tracks. But we already speak, you know, we share a vernacular that was applicable to the movie, although I think people do think they understand the music more than they do, because it's very sophisticated. It's all bespoke.
Let's take a listen to it, and we'll come back and talk about it more.
One thing. So the John Wick theme, one of the main themes from the first film, was the foundation for this. And then Cassandra Nostalgia, who did songs with me on the first film, is in the second movie with myself and Dylan Island, a.k.a. La Castlevania. He's a DJ who does club music for these John Wick movies. And he's also a dear friend. So we're in the second one in some avant-garde band. So what we chose to do was augment the main theme in song form. And Cassandra, she sang on it.
Cool. All right. Well, this is Plastic Heart from John Wick Chapter 2. I mentioned before that you've become known for scoring action for films like 300, John Wick, Deadpool. Can you talk about your approach to scoring action? Are you trying, for example, to highlight or accent pieces of the action sequence? Or is it you're trying to create more of an underlying bed of tension throughout the scene, or both?
Definitely both. John Wick has a very balletic quality to it because Chad Stahelski, the director, is a master martial artist and marksman, the whole deal.
So, it is balletic, absolutely.
Yeah, so the way he choreographs and shoots action is he really wants to show the audience the whole art form. Mm-hmm. And you have to take that into consideration. Almost like in 300, where Zach would go into those ramp speed into like slow-mo shots. And there's a way to score that stuff. And it's not that easy.
No, I don't imagine.
So it takes a while to experiment. And actually, Chad and Dave were in 300 because those guys were the stunt coordinators and the fight trainers for that movie.
Persians or Greeks?
They were on the Greek side.
Okay, that's good.
And,
good guys.
So anyway, yeah. Look, the action movie thing, look, it's a task. It's the assignment. I'm always curious to learn. And I'm not like an atypical action movie person. Violence is not something that I'm a huge, you know, fan of or consumer of. I don't really like to see sadistic things, you know, filmed. But it does impact the work that I do when I am, you know, working with visuals that are depicting that kind of violence.
Well, I want to play the audience a couple of samples of like two very different kinds of action scores. Sure. That you've done. Very different tones. Without a doubt, the directors must have been really happy. You're opening up the audience's adrenal glands in both cases. The first one is called Hard Way or Easy Way from Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw. Let's take a quick peek at that. Go ahead. I love this drummer. Did you write the drum track?
Yes. Yeah. But it's Gil. Cool. It's Gil Sharon again. My drummer cool. Hero.
Prog punk.
This is comedic. Okay, it's violent, but it's comedic.
Ah.
So that's why you're getting those notes. This cue I probably did in maybe an hour. I mean, I didn't have any time.
I mean, you're supposed to make this sound hard and like,
it took hard.
It took 2 weeks and
no, I.
But that's the thing. You're bringing 30 years of craft to it.
There you
make
go.
It look easy. It's yes. not easy. Most people can't do that in an hour.
But the very detailed action music, when you see a 2-3 minute sequence, car chases and, you know, aerial shots and all that, and it's orchestral and it's electronic and, yeah, I mean.
And it has to work with the picture.
That takes sometimes days because you're tempo mapping things so intricately to follow the footage and not become lazy and and smear over the various chapters of the scene.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So
the beats of the scene,
if
yeah.
you will. That's extremely detailed and it mostly is muted by noise. We do that.
The great battle between sound effects editors and music editors.
No, the soundtrack album is proof. Right. It's like there was music there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, here's another action piece, very different. This one is from, it's called Kraglin and Drax, and it's from Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Let's listen to this. This is from Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. It's called Kraglin and Drax. You slipped some odd time signatures in there. Was that like a cool way of syncing the music to the action? Or is there another reason you're putting like 7/4 in there and 3/4 bars in the middle of all this 4/4 straight time?
Yeah, well, you know, we do what we have to do to land the cuts, you know.
Right,
and
so
then these movies are constantly being edited.
Right.
So,
well, no, they're not. You're supposed to get locked picture when you're writing music.
The best you'll get is what they call latched, and that means we've made up our mind mostly, but we're still
cutting.
Oh, no.
Oh,
so
God.
There's no such thing as a lock picture. Once you create a sequence like this, and you have to get into it, you can't wait till the end. It's just too much work. So you're right, and then with each cut, okay, well, we're just going to put a bar of 15, 16 in there.
and now it syncs back up again.
I mean, sometimes there's 1/16 in there because there's just no time to re-tempo map everything
and
rebar it. So fortunately, I've worked with some phenomenal orchestras that know how to interpret that stuff. And just they're
amazing.
Make me look good.
It amazes me when you see go to your concerts by people like Shostakovich and Stravinsky, how these 100 people on stage are counting these ridiculous additive times, like 16, 17. It's like, I couldn't do that.
Well, just imagine when the orchestra at Abbey Road is playing this down.
Yeah.
First time they've ever looked at the music.
Right.
And
they
just play. Sounds like it. It's like,
that's
oh
amazing.
My God.
Well, when you're writing an orchestral score, how many parts do you break it down into? I mean, at some point, hopefully you're using the help of an orchestrator, right? So you're not writing parts out for 60 different instruments.
Correct.
Are you writing like roots for sections or?
Well, it happens so intensely. There's no time for reflection. There's no time for me to pull a pencil and paper out. I hand it off to Tim Williams, who has graciously handled the orchestrations for me throughout my career mostly, and is my conductor mostly as well.
Tyler, I wish we could go on all night, but our time is just about out. For every time I have you on the show, time goes by so quickly. I apologize for interrupting you. Folks, next time on The Soundtrack, we're going to visit with and listen to the music of another guitarist slash composer. This gentleman's been a key creative collaborator with Tears for Fears since 2004, when he began co-writing, co-producing, and mixing their studio work, and has been their lead guitarist on tour, Mr. Charlton Pettis. Tyler, you know Charlton, right?
Yeah, we're
small
friends.
Small world here in Los Angeles. Tyler, thank you again, man, so much for joining us tonight. I want to tell you, as your friend, I worry about how driven and hard and work-obsessed you are. But as a fan, I'm really happy that you work so hard. So thank you.
Oh, I've joined the circus now. I'm a tour man.
All right, guys, I'm going to leave you with another Tyler Bates piece. This is called Quill's Big Retreat from Guardians of the Galaxy, the original score. Guys, thanks for listening to The Soundtrack. See you next time.